Gibbs, founder of Incandescent Public Relations, publisher of Be Incandescent Business Magazine, and your host for the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. Hi, this is Hope Gibbs with the Incandescent Radio Network. We are here in sunny Los Angeles with award-winning journalist Ashley Merriman. She and Poe Bronson, her co-author, made headlines in September 2009 when they released Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Indeed, their anti-parenting manual is an insightful exploration of themes and issues that transcend children and adults' lives. Intelligence, racism, civility and aggression, honesty and deception. It's just a fabulous, game-changing book. Their new book is quite the same. Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, which was released in February 2013, is another fascinating exploration that is chock full of research and keen analysis. They answer questions including, what are the differences between a winning and losing performance? Why are we able to rise to the challenge one day, but wilt from it the next? And most importantly, perhaps, they help readers determine if they can, in fact, become better competitors. We had the opportunity to interview Poe in his hometown of San Francisco last month, so we are thrilled to be here today in Los Angeles at the home of Ashley Merriman. This author and public speaker holds a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the University of California School of Cinematic Arts and a Juris Doctorate from Georgetown University. Before launching her writing career, she was a litigation attorney and a speechwriter in the Clinton administration. Here in Los Angeles, she also directs an all-volunteer tutoring program for inner-city kids. For her civic involvement, she received commendations from both the Clinton and Bush administrations. So welcome to the Incandescent Radio Network, Ashley.
Hi, thank you.
So we are really excited to talk to you about Top Dog. You and Poe are Entrepreneurs of the Month in the July 2013 issue of Be Incandescent magazine.
Yay!
So we are looking forward to you sharing some insights today with our readers. So tell us first, what inspired you to write Top Dog?
Well, you know, in Nurture Shock, we sort of became famous for being anti-trophies and anti-empty praise and constantly telling kids that they were wonderful. And, you know, your description of the book, you know, it's not anti-parenting, it's anti-parenting manual. So we just want to make sure we're not against any parents, right? But I think the question then became, well, if everyone shouldn't get a trophy, if everyone shouldn't be told they're wonderful, who gets the trophy? Who does get to be told? When should you tell a kid or yourself or your coworker, yes, you're the best? And what does that do to performance? And at the same time, while I was sort of struggling with those questions and a lot of parents were talking about it, then I also was looking at the new science that was coming out that was the most interesting. And I was really amazed by Steve Garcia's work at the University of Michigan. And Steve's the researcher who found that the more students who took the SAT at the same location at the same time, the lower everyone scores. And I immediately said, how? Why? What's that about? There's that expression, don't get lost in the crowd. And I think that's told from the perspective of the person standing outside of the crowd looking in. And I actually think it's the reverse. The research says that it really is about you getting lost in the crowd, because competition, it turns out, is personal. It's, I know how much I studied on the SAT vocabulary section, but you're better than me in math, so I really better step up here. I can't take this for granted. And knowing that the guy is sitting over on us for 3 rows ago, he went to all of those Kaplan test programs and he just, you know, sail through everything. So we're really going to have to concentrate. The more people doing it at the same time, the less you're able to pick out those individuals who can show you what you've accomplished and what they've accomplished. And it is, you start losing yourself in the crowd because everyone just seems too big and you can't figure out what you're doing, what someone else is doing. And what's interesting, we write in the book that Steve Garcia says, you know, there's this sort of buzz in education policy after a couple of studies found that kids did better in smaller classrooms. And the assumption was that smaller classrooms meant more interaction between the student and the teacher, and that's why they worked. But Steve says, actually, no, it may be peer-to-peer. It may have been that more students were there, and you can't get lost in a classroom of only 10 or 20 kids, and everybody knows when you bombed a quiz or did really well. There's 30 or 40 kids, you can kind of jam that F into the notebook before anybody notices and kind of get by and pull back from the dialogue. But Steve actually says it applies in a much larger context. He says that when you think about it, like every time Obama or any business executive says, you know, we need to become more competitive as a nation. We can't take this competition. We're competing against the whole world now. There's a billion people in China who want your job. We expect that to be motivating. Oh my gosh, I've got to step up the game. But Steve's research says we might all go, wow, there's a billion people who want this job? I don't know how to prepare for that. I can't study for that. And you take your foot off the gas. Hmm. So you may actually be working less hard with all of these things which we actually think are supposed to be motivating.
That's just fascinating. So this is at the heart of your research, that you synthesized all this information. How many sources did you have? Do you even have a number?
No.
It was
thousands.
Thousands, yeah, it's amazing. Well, we're sitting in your apartment and we're looking at all your notes and it's phenomenal. You can sort of see what's happened in your brain.
This is all the stuff I print out. It's not the stuff that I actually read. Right. The stuff I print out is stuff that I actually want to spend time with, hours with. You know, I go through hundreds, thousands of titles, abstracts before I start going, yes, this is the research. And, you know, for Nurture Shock, I would try and read every single study, every researcher that researcher had published, and anything ever citing anything that researcher had done. And top dog research, it wasn't quite the same just because the topics were different. And, you know, some researchers like Steve Garcia, I read all of his papers and every paper that cited him. But other people, only maybe two or three papers related to competition, but the rest of what they were doing didn't have anything to do with it. But yeah, it's... If you printed everything out on my computer, we're talking tens of thousands of pages.
Amazing. Very impressive. And you use that information to explain game-changing insights into the nature of competition. Now, I want to talk about something that really fascinated me. Why does the home field advantage in sports? How is that just as relevant in diplomacy and deal-making?
Well, it's perfect. We're here at my house, right? And I already set the ground rules before you guys got here, which is that I'm sort of sloppy and there's papers and books and unread books everywhere. And I gave you the rules, right, in terms of where you could sit, what you were going to do. I mean, I brought you cookies and I hope you like the cookies.
Yum, they were great, thank you.
but I set the stage. I decided what was going to make you comfortable or not comfortable. My goal right now is to make you comfortable, but we're not in a good negotiation. We're here to talk about the book and I'm excited to do that. And however you comfortable are, then we have a better conversation. But if I was trying to get a promotion from you, or if I was trying to get a sales deal from you, that's a very different circumstance. And what the research says is that, you know, an NBA team is going to win it, depending, let's just call it 60% of the time when they're at home. So it's not a slam dunk, but there's a definite advantage. But Graham Brown, a researcher who does things in the UK and Singapore, has found that all interactions have a home field advantage. And it's not that you have to actually live here like I do. Just getting to a restaurant earlier, you know, you're going to, in quote unquote, neutral territory, right? There's an expression for neutral territory for a reason. If you just get there for a few minutes early, move the salt shakers to where you want them, put some papers around, learn the waiter's name, you've established that this is your home base and they have to come in, and that's going to change it. Brown's research has found that the person with the home field advantage can get up to 160% more value from the negotiation than the person who came just 5-10 minutes later. If you can negotiate for a raise for your boss, you're going to get better if you're doing it in your office than theirs. And I told this to a friend of mine, and he went, no one gets to negotiate for the arrays in their own office. And I said, exactly. And his face just fell and he went, oh. And I was like, yeah, right. Because it's about this sense of, and it seems to be there are some evolutionary roots, but we know from performance, it changes how strongly you're aggressive, how much you defend a point, how much you defend a personal attack. The fact that you're successful is more exciting when you're at home, because it's more fulfilling. And the person who's not home, the away team, so to speak, defers to that, understands, oh, okay, you're going to be more aggressive and my strength is going to be on deflecting your aggression rather than putting forth to it. And it's sort of interesting. They've done this, you know, with kids, playing games, economic games in preschool, and depending on if they were in their class or the classroom down the hall meant they won or lost.
Wow.
My favorite example, especially since you're based in the DC area, you're more likely to vote for a school bond initiative if your polling place is a school. You just can't say no to a school when you're in the school. But that applies everywhere. There's a couple researchers now who wonder if the setting is determinative in a way that's almost inescapable. So researchers have looked and found that if you put, sculptures up in a church on the way into a polling station for Catholics at the Catholic Church and they see the statues, they vote more moralistically on the poll. Unbelievers, people who are not part of that faith, they're not affected by it. But the Catholics go, ooh. And the same if you go to a different temple or a different religion, the people who are members of that, once you've sort of given them visual reminders, this is what we believe as a group, changes their votes.
Fascinating. Along those lines, tell us how men and women compete differently. We were talking, I was just at the Professional Businesswomen of California conference where Sheryl Sandberg, and I see you have her book Lean In on your,
of course,
on your, right? So she was the keynote speaker and she talked a lot about leaning in. So first let's talk about the research that you uncovered and then I'd love to talk about your thoughts about this concept of leaning in.
Sure. Well, I'm sure Poe said some of this, but just in case he didn't, one of the disclaimers we have to say is neither of us wanted to write about gender differences. I mean, militantly. This was like danger, danger, Will Robinson. Don't go there. There are dragons there. And Poe felt very strongly that. I felt very strongly, I'm a woman. I'm competitive. And I have been told really throughout my professional career that women weren't as competitive as men and that our strength was to be coalition builders. That was what really we should do. And I still have, I could find it somewhere on that bookshelf over there, a couple books that someone, when I worked in the Clinton administration, my boss, a woman, gave me, which were about the keys to women's leadership, which was women should coalition build and not compete. She was a cabinet secretary. And I read this and I'm like, this is just not fitting in with my personality, any of the people I know at Georgetown Law School, which is where I was going at the time. And I just keep going, no one is going to tell me that Hillary Clinton, by the virtue of being a woman, is less competitive than, say, Michael Phelps or President Clinton,
right?
I mean, nobody's going to convince me of that. So I was really worried that I didn't want the research we found to say women are less competitive and therefore they can't compete and therefore they shouldn't compete. And that's the reason someone would nightmarishly hold up my book and say, well, that's why women aren't going to be in the corner office and never should. Wow, I was not going to let that happen. But I kept looking at the research. We talked about how much research I go through, and it got important. I mean, for Nurture Shock, we read about kids' individual differences and kids' gender differences all of the time. There are scientific journals that will not publish your study unless you separately report the findings for the men and the women.
Really?
You have to at least say there was no statistical difference. But if you didn't even indicate to the peer review staff that you haven't separately looked at that number, you are getting that journal article sent back. But even said that, when you looked at the actual comparisons, most of the time it was a 2 or 3% swing, which, we always talk about there's the difference between statistically significant and meaningfully statistical. And there we were like, yeah, no, I mean, I guess in some ways I might be your stereotypically female, girlish, no athletic ability whatsoever, I can barely walk across a room. But if you put the Williams sisters in a study about athleticism, really, is gender the factor? I don't think so. So individual differences didn't really seem to be something, or they seemed to be actually trumping the gender differences in the research we had read for Nurture Shock. But in the competition literature, we were seeing gaps of 30%, 40%. That's a lot. That's too much to say, well, I don't even need to read the study. I need to read the study and what's going on. And so we kept sort of looking at it, but I still kept going, I don't know, I don't know. And then I found the work of Sarah Fulton. And Sarah changed everything for us, for both Poe and me. And Sarah is a poli-sci professor out of the Texas A&M, and she had surveyed 875 sitting state legislators. And she asked them, are you going to run for Congress? Or are you, and if you did run in the next general, would you win? And what she found was that for the men, there was really no correlation between their likelihood of winning and their actual running. They wanted to do it because of a myriad of different reasons. There's an issue I believe in, it's my time, but the fact that you were guaranteed to win or lose just really wasn't the factor. But for women, that's what it was. They only wanted to compete if they had at least a 50-50 shot at winning. And the more likely it was that they were gonna win, the more likely they were gonna go. So then we went back and we looked at all those other studies saying women can't compete. And what we realized is all of them were looking at the initial decision to compete. Am I willing to get in this? And there we found out pretty consistently, men were saying yes, no problem. And women were saying, I don't know, am I gonna win? And if they said, I don't think I can win this, then they wouldn't compete. There wasn't any evidence that found that women were less determined, passionate, once they had made a commitment to compete. But that was that thing, that initial moment, and that changed everything. So now we were like, okay, well, so the question now is why? Why are they so different? What is so important to women about winning than men? Which you sort of think archetypically the opposite, right? If men are competing all the time, it must be because they want to win. But it turns out they don't really care. Is it okay if I go on?
Oh, please.
Okay, well, I'm just talking. I don't know if you want shorter answers and
no,
questions.
No, keep talking.
Okay. So the question then is, why? And that's when we found the research of Joyce Benenson, who's a researcher at Harvard and at Emmanuel College. And she is both an evolutionary psychologist and also a social psychologist doing work in the lab. And Joyce's theory is that women are more cautious about the risks because basically they grow up playing in pairs. And men grow up playing in groups.
I'm so glad you're talking about this because this fascinates me.
Oh my gosh, this changed my world. This absolutely 100% changed my world. And first, but let, you know, you got to think about, well, why is that? Because that's A, it sounds crazy, and B, what does that mean? Well, we're not talking about, again, small differences. By 6 years old, boys spend 74% of their time in a group in a in an experimental setting, 74% of their time will be spent in some sort of group. You know, when you're given, you know, how anybody can play any way they want. Girls, it's 16% of their time in groups. They're mostly in, you know, it's those cute little toe-headed girls sitting together comparing ringlets. And if you time the interactions, boys, especially young boys, interactions in that pair are half as long as those as girls. And my favorite, which I just think is hysterically funny, if you put two boys in a room and you force them to talk to each other in the lab, what do they talk about? You know, if we had a few more boys here, we could play a game and that'd be really great. So boys in a pair talk about how great it would be to be in a group. That's just part of the group experience. And girls are pairs. In fact, if you put girls in a group, they sometimes subdivide into pairs.
That's what Poe said about his soccer team.
Yes, exactly. And I actually was giving a speech recently and I was looking through some photo bucket and Flickr at girls in playgrounds and found amazing pictures where in theory all of the girls had gone out for a snowball fight, but out of the 9 girls in the shot, at least half of them are in pairs. Even though it's clearly one group, they've all still just subdivided. So when you think about it, in a group, they're organized on a purpose, right? We're all gonna meet here at 3 o'clock after school every day to play basketball. And everybody signs on to this. And this is just kids, right? This isn't some organized with, you know, adults and levels. And because of that, you understand that there are gonna be some kids who are really good at playing basketball, some who are gonna be okay, and some are gonna be terrible. Right? I mean, that's, but they're still going to come as long as everybody shows up at 3 o'clock. It doesn't matter. So we actually had this idea that groups build, you know, sameness and groupthink. But groups over time actually encourage individualism. Because I accept that you may not be as good at basketball as I am, but you're the planner. Or maybe you're the class clown, or you're the kid who's going to help us with our math homework once we've finished playing basketball. But we understand these different roles, so we can actually use them as a sort of safety net to become individuals. Because even if I do a weird thing, as long as I'm still signed up for that purpose, it's okay. Now, another part of groups that are different is that in a group, you gotta yell. You gotta at one point say, hey everybody, throw me the ball, I'm over here. Because if you don't yell, and you don't say, I can do it, nobody's gonna give you the ball. They're gonna forget you're there. So over time, these groups are teaching you that it's okay to brag, it's okay to yell about your accomplishments, and it's also okay when you get the ball to throw it and miss. Because if you get every basket on Monday, you still come back on Tuesday. If you miss every basket on Tuesday, you still come back on Wednesday. So over time, groups are teaching you it's not about winning or losing. You do that and then you move on because it's still about continuing that purpose. And if there's an argument, you know, I don't really like you, you were being mean to me, somebody else can say, hey, we're not here for counseling, we're here to play ball. So shut up, here's the ball, right? So there's, again, it's reminding you what the purpose was. Now in a pair-based, it's completely different. You could put the most ardent fan of Rush Limbaugh and the most ardent fan of Obama in a room by themselves, let them talk, and they don't want to find difference, they want to find common ground. They want to find shared experiences, things that they can communicate with and agree upon and find some sort of equality. And that's grown-ups. Think about a 3 or 4 or 5 year old little girl who wants a friend, right? They, you know, it's, do you like Candyland? Do you? Do you like Candyland? No, really, do you like Candyland?
I do, I love Candyland.
You do, you love Candyland. Oh my gosh, that's so great, because I have it right over there. We could play. You want to come over to my house and we could play? You want to play?
Absolutely.
Oh, oh my gosh. And I know you like the chocolate chip cookies. Those are your favorites, right?
They are.
See, even if you hate chocolate chip,
I'm going
to
say yes.
You have to say yes, right? Because it would be rude to tell me that my favorite cookie wasn't good, right?
Or and my favorite, too.
Or my favorite, exactly. So you have to, so peers, pairs in these peer relationships are finding common ground. They're finding sameness. They're finding agreement. Whereas the groups, everyone is allowed to say, hey, I think that cookie sucks, because 3 other kids will say, I like chocolate chip, I'll eat yours. No big deal. But in a pair, it becomes, conflict becomes a more personal attack on who you are. Mm-hmm. And there's no larger purpose to look past. There's no mediator who can come up and say, you two are blowing this cookie problem out of proportion. There's only us.
So is this why consensus was what your one boss was going toward?
Well, I think that what I've been thinking about lately is in a meeting where, someone has a question, I sit, you know, the person next to me, I start scribbling notes. Hey, I was thinking, do you think if I asked this question, that would be a good question? Or I had this idea, do you think this would be a good idea? Now, people might say I was coalition building support before I brought my idea to a group. But what I would actually tell you is I'm doing the same thing Sarah Fulton's publisher did. I mean, the same thing Sarah Fulton's legislators were doing. I'm looking for the guaranteed win. Uh-huh. I want to know in advance that this is successful. Now, what's crazy is that I let the person next to me, I made a pair in a group, overcome my opinion of whether or not it's a good idea, right? Stupid. But that's that risk aversion, the idea that I can't bring it to the group unless I already have it pre-approved, mm-hmm. that I'm, you know, guaranteed of that support. And I do. I think that actually is part of that sort of pair-based. And another one of the things that Benenson talks about is that women are very leery of standing out in a group, because in a peer, you've got to be equal, right? Peers teach you that competition means you could lose the relationship you care about the very most. And if you're going to lose the relationship you love the most, your very best friend, you better win.
Right. I love when you said that. I've been saying that ever since I heard you say that in D.C.
I have too. I'm like, oh my God, yeah. I have to win. Yeah. And so I think that's also there. Was, you know, if I'm willing to make myself a target at a meeting because I have a controversial idea, then it better be good. Mm-hmm. And I better make sure that I'm gonna win. Because if I'm going out alone, at least I'm going home with the trophy or the promotion or the raise or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Benenson's found that college-educated women never talk about their accomplishments with someone unless they know that the person they're talking to is equally or more accomplished than they.
Why?
Because it's about it's about finding that and maintaining that equal status.
Right.
If I know that, you know, I've written 2 books and I know you've written 2 books or 3 or 4, well, then I can talk to you. But if I don't know what you've done, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, I'm bragging, you know, which is really hard in an interview, right?
Right. Do you know what's so interesting? I do a lot of networking, and the feedback I've gotten recently was, you know, I'll meet someone and I'll say what I do and I'll ask them what they do and then we'll kind of move on. But then I'll be called on during the conference or the lecture to talk about what I do, or I'll make a presentation, and they'll come up to me afterward and they'll be like, I had no idea that you've accomplished all that, or I want to talk to you more. Why didn't you tell me initially? And I was in a group with 3 women, and one of them said that to me, and the third one said, she doesn't have to. But, you know, that, and I feel that way as well. Like, I don't have to brag about who I am.
I don't think it's that she shouldn't have to, it's that you shouldn't.
Right, that's
not
right.
The same thing. I mean,
right.
You know, there's, I live in L.A., and, mm-hmm. you know, I sort of joke occasionally, you know, if you have to tell people you're famous, you're probably not.
Right.
So there's this idea, you know, if I shouldn't have to tell you about my accomplishments because you should already know them.
Well,
most people don't know about your accomplishments.
No, that's not what I meant, but yes.
But I think it's more the, because it would be inappropriate.
Right.
I mean, I tell, you know, I'm hanging out with some of my friends, and all of a sudden I'll just sort of burst out with a, can I brag? Yes, Ashley, what? And 9 times out of 10, you can't see it at the moment, but there's piles and balls of yarn everywhere that there isn't a book. And I'm a really terrible crocheter. And when I'm on the book tour, I crochet people's scarves when I'm on the plane. And so, can I brag? Yes, Ashley, what? I finished more crocheting scarves. I'm so proud. Can I show you? Sure. Why do I need approval to introduce to something that's fairly de minimis to the conversation? But it's still something that was important to me and I consider an accomplishment. Can you imagine a guy
asking for approval to
saying, brag? Hey, guys, before we go shoot pool, can I brag? They were looking at, what are you talking about? Just spit it out already.
Right.
And I do. I think it's that, you know, holding ourselves out is uncomfortable because is visible the same as saying I'm better than you because I did something and you didn't.
Right. So girls aren't comfortable with that. So let's bring in the lean in conversation.
Sure.
Because she does talk quite a bit about this. And so,
although she has a hard time too, right?
She admits that, right?
60 Minutes interview,
right,
where they said, what did you do and why are you successful? And they said, in your book, you said women don't talk about why they're successful. They attribute it to other things like luck. So why were you successful, Sheryl Sandberg? And her reply was luck.
Right. And she talked to
us. She still couldn't do it, even though she had written a part of her book about it. They called her on it, and she agreed, and they said, so why are you successful? And she said, look.
Right.
This is not an easy thing.
Right. We're socialized not to brag, like I'm saying, right? So
I'm
how do we?
Trying a little bit. I'm trying to realize I don't need a sure thing.
To get it out there.
Yeah. I do think that we need to be careful. Because right now there's an idea, or at least a conversation, you know, women don't negotiate for a higher salary when they're going to get a job, so they should. But the research says that women who do negotiate for a higher job don't necessarily get the higher salary, and in fact are hired with a negative perspective, that they're aggressive and dominating, and will get downgraded on their performance before they even begin. I'm not even convinced they get hired at the same rate. So we have to be a little careful. I wouldn't say go ahead and brag every time. I would say if you're being hypersensitive about something that's important to you in a community, that, you know, friends or coworkers who you trust, that you don't need to minimize something. You can be factual. But am I saying drop all of that? No, we're socialized for a reason.
Right. Yeah. Well, what was so interesting to me, the biggest takeaways from the 23rd when she spoke in the morning, and there were 4,000 women in this auditorium listening to her speak, which was really impressive. I wish you were there too. Actually, I think you should speak at the next one. We'll talk about that later.
Cool.
But she said, how many of you at one point in your careers have said out loud, I want to be the president of this organization, whether it's your own company or a Cisco, wherever you're working. And me, the woman who was on my panel, Bonnie Harvey, who founded Barefoot Wine, and about, I'm not kidding you, 15 other women out of 4,000 stood up. So she went on to talk about that and why we don't do that. But then she asked later in the conversation, how many of you have been called aggressive on the job by a boss? I am telling you, 9 out of 10 hands went up, which is really fascinating, right? So it's telling what how we're being perceived. And it's, it plays exactly to that research that you just
said. And what's really interesting and something that's important, I think, to keep in mind, the gender patterns that we fall into, it's not just about looking at how you fall into it. And my goal isn't to put, you know, women in a box and say, okay, because you're hypersensitive and do more elaborate risk calculations, these are the better kinds of jobs you should do. You would be better CFO instead of entrepreneur founder. Mm-hmm. Maybe a particular person would or wouldn't, but that's not my goal. My goal is for you to say, when there's a risk, am I picking a buy on this when I really should just go for this? Mm-hmm. And helping you to look for those different elements that are going on. But you also need to understand that these same patterns, even though we aren't consciously aware of them, are in terms of how people perceive us.
Right.
Guys on a date, a pair-based interaction. And we talked before about how two different people can be in a room and they're going to find common ground, right? But a guy on a date can brag to the new girl.
Well, you know, I've just got a promotion and my mother thinks I'm the best thing on the planet, or whatever it is he's going to do. But she expects that. She expects that even in this pair-based relationship, the guy is going to be acting as the group member.
Whereas women in a boardroom meeting are supposed to say, look around the room and wait to take their turn, because that's what you do in a pair. And some young women I've been talking to lately even make the mistake of raising their hands during a board meeting. Don't need to do that, by the way. But, I mean, and I actually did that. I remember the first couple times I was in a meeting and I was, you know, right out of college. I'm like, oh, we don't raise hands here? Oh, when do I talk? You just do an idea. You just talk. But that can be off-putting. And, you know, there's studies about how women put forward ideas in rooms, but they're not heard as much. And I think some of that may have to do with the presentation style. It's mm-hmm. not that we're ignoring women, but the women who are still worried about standing out may couch the idea. Well, what would you think if we did this instead of saying the company's going to go down in flames if we don't do this way, which is my idea and we got to go now? So we may be underselling the presentation because even in a group, we're still playing by the rules of that pair.
So what's the trick? I remember the last time I had a full-time job. I was sitting there initially. I was new to the
full-time job.
Well, no, this was not my company. I worked for somebody else.
Lest we forget.
And I was sharing ideas, and I would interject as the conversation was going. And the guy who owned the company said to me, Hope, you know, I really appreciate your ideas, but it would be better if you jotted them down in the margins, and then at the end we could go back to them. Which was like strike one against that fellow. But, but you know, it's so interesting. I think you have to read the dynamic
you
and
really
see who's
do.
Old school, who's kind of coming up through the ranks in a different way. Sheryl Sandberg actually points out that one of the men who works for her was talking about how, in terms of the aggression, that there was an assessment done based on performance, and this one woman was marked as being very aggressive. So after he had read or talked about Cheryl's book, he came to her and he said, listen, this is what's going on in my department. What I want to do is I'm going to go and talk to the managers and find out exactly how she's been aggressive. How is their perception coloring this ranking? And, you know, so she feels like, you know, that's changing the conversation, that now men especially are saying, well, maybe the aggression is something that is my perception, not really this woman being aggressive.
That's tough. I mean, I've read, actually, I think, at least in her TED Talk and in the book, so maybe this was what she was talking about, the Heidi Roizen case study.
Right, the Heidi Howard.
And I've read all of the Heidi and Howard, and personally, no one asked me, but I hated both of them. I mean, I don't know this person in, like, real life, but, I mean, in the case study, whether it was Howard or Heidi, founded a company with shall we say, there collectively, Heidi Howard, founded a company with her brother, cut her brother out when he wasn't in keeping with what she wanted to do with the company so she could make more money and sell it over. I don't really like that person if they're a male or female. Maybe that's because I don't have siblings. So for me, the idea of having a sibling relationship is a bond that I don't completely grasp on a more emotional level. I know all the psychological literature for it. But so for me, it was kind of hard because I felt like both of them were so aggressive and so combative, and I wasn't really going rah-rah in either case. It was interesting that that case study had the people reading it were feeling more sympathetic to Howard and less tolerant of the female version's actions. But in terms of, you know, how does that work in the business context now, I think that's tough. Mm-hmm. I think it's tough because, yes, I do think, as I said, there are gender expectations and that women might be read as being aggressive, doing the same exact thing that the guy did. On the other hand, as we both know, the dismal numbers, less than 4% about of VC-funded companies are headed by women.
Right.
Hardly any women in Fortune 500 or Fortune 1000. Congress, everyone was saying, yay, Congress, so many women elected. We got up to, I think, 18%. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the right number?
I think so.
That's not a celebration. That's cause for embarrassment. But it's the reality. Okay, so who are those 4%? Mm-hmm. Who are those 18%? My guess is they're the toughest, most aggressive, strongest, most fearless women you could possibly imagine, because they had to be.
Yeah.
So then it's hard to say, well, that woman's being rated as aggressive. She might be, because it was a skill that she needed, either she had to begin with or acquired it to be that successful. And I'm not saying that as any sort of critique. I'm saying that she pushed and fought for that job, and other women who didn't have the strength, weren't convinced enough that they were good enough, for whatever reason, they dropped out.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me. I don't want to necessarily say, oh, that woman's not aggressive, because maybe she was.
Right.
But that's still not necessarily a bad thing. But it's weird then. I don't want to put Band-Aids on things without recognizing the accomplishments, but also the challenges of the people who are in the workforce now. And that's then different maybe than 10 or 20 years down the road when, if we're talking about women being the majority of colleges and with baby boomers at a company suddenly all retire in the same couple of years, all of a sudden a bunch of women may get promoted and not have had that same sort of cutthroat experience that they had to fight through. So then rules may be different in terms of how should they be rated, how we should talk about it. But so it's different right now, and I'm just not sure what the right answer is.
Yeah. Do you have a solution? Do you think? I mean, the conversation is there. Anne-Marie Slaughter started the conversation, Women Have It All, which was sort of a different nuance to it. But this idea of leaning in and standing up for yourself, what is your perspective on what women do need to do to be more effective in their careers?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I know that the Atlantic piece caused a huge buzz, but that wasn't the catalyst for it. And what's amazing to me is when you look back at the research and even the popular media, pretty much the, oh my gosh, can we have it all, was asked almost as soon as anyone tried to have it all.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who it was, if it was Helen Gurley Brown or Betty Friedan or somebody, but in the early 1970s, one of these women who was considered part of the leading revolution, a woman walked up to her during a convention and said, after, women can do everything, we can be all, we can have it all. The woman said, but why didn't you tell us it would be this so hard? And her response was, because we didn't know.
Mm. Fair enough.
But I mean, it was pretty much as soon as everybody started doing it, people started realizing, oh my gosh. I mean, my image of the sort of prototypical American nuclear family, I think it's still a Leave It to Beaver scenario, right? Mm-hmm. The mom in Leave It to Beaver worked. She was an actress. She was probably never at home. She was on the set learning her lines. Even our examples, Ozzie and Harriet worked. She raised two kids on a TV set. So we're all having that balance. It's whether or not we've had, you know, the ability to actually talk about it.
Right.
And I think especially early on, the sort of first wave of women in the workplace weren't allowed to talk about it because it made them seem weak and girly. And their whole point was treat me the same as everybody else. And once we got past that, then we could start asking those sort of questions again. I don't know the right answer. I know in terms of individuals, because, you know, in some, you know, there's the policy level, well, what should we do? But then there's also, well, yeah, at some point, though, two of us are working, you know, and somebody's got to pick up the kid and somebody's got to make dinner. Who's it going to be? What's going to happen? You know, the research says that men and women, the more they share housework and they share child-rearing, they're happier.
The better their marriage.
The better their marriage.
The longer it lasts.
But I also think that's, but again, there are individual differences. A conservative family actually is quite happy with a more traditional breadwinner structure. And, you know, if the man really wants to be the breadwinner and wants a mom at home, and then she's, and he are probably happier. And also, presumably, she's in the same mindset. But then, yeah, they're actually happier when it's less equal. I mean, I think that we do need to, you know, look at the structural elements, which are factors. But I don't know if there is one right answer right now.
Yeah. Or if there ever will be. It's so indispensable, you know. It's just if you want it, it'd be nice if you could actually get it, that there weren't things standing in your way.
Well, but I also think right now in the economic situation is that there isn't a choice.
Right.
It's just moot. And one thing I've really been thinking about a lot for the past couple weeks, sort of in light of the whole Lean In book coming out and everything, and I still think right now in the society, and I don't know how current this is compared to even evolutionary hunter-gatherer kind of bifurcation, but at least right now, we can talk about now, there's still an idea that the man is the breadwinner, mm-hmm. and that working is a choice for the woman. And I think that's really important, and we can't forget that. It changes for me the work-life balance dialogue. Because when you think about it, if a guy is supposed to be the breadwinner and he gets a promotion, the fact that he has to stay home late and miss his kid's soccer game is okay. Because the promotion, the increased social status, the increased money meant he was fulfilling his obligation to his family. But a woman, and we're going to leave aside the fact that there may be economic realities, she doesn't have a choice, maybe she just really loves her career, but there's an illusion that she has the choice, and that for her, work is going to be done at the detriment of the family. So if she gets a promotion, the family still may get this, may get more money or more status, but for her, her focus in that promotion is what are the costs, the fact that I'm going to miss that soccer game, and not, but it's good for the family anyway, where the guy has it. So I think that sort of changes the perspective. I mean, Sarah Fulton's research, the poli-sci professor I was talking about earlier, you know, men, she's found, find that if you have a family, if you have children, that increases the likelihood of your being a candidacy. And you sort of think of, you know, the Kennedy brother, band of brothers, we're all gonna go knock on doors together and it'll be a bonding experience and it'll be great for the whole family. All the kids will learn and be introduced to people and it'll be great. And for the women, being married or having kids is a detriment to the likelihood you're gonna run.
Yeah.
Because the women are thinking, oh my gosh, this is gonna be so hard on my kids and my husband's gonna be mad and it's gonna put a strain on my marriage. So they actually see it in the complete opposite.
Yeah, fascinating, right?
Yeah, and I do think that that sort of conversation is part of the thing that we're leaving out in terms mm-hmm. of the when do we go and not. That understanding and thinking, you know, is this an asset or is this a bet, you know, or a cost,
right.
is really changing, is changing the mindset and it changes your result.
Yeah.
Because especially if you're a woman and you're thinking, what are the costs or here are the known costs? I'm going to be tired. I'm going to be away from my kids. I'm going to have to ask my husband for more help.
the other women in the PTA are going to complain that I didn't actually make a cake and I bought it at the store, or whatever it is that they're thinking in their head, right? Rightly or wrongly. And they may, you know, all of those moms may be too busy doing their own stuff to notice, but in your mind, you may be thinking this, right? That changes then, we're going back to that women's risk calculation. All of those costs are known. The benefit of the promotion is a question mark. What if I don't even get the promotion? Or if I get the promotion, but I still don't know how much more money it's going to be, maybe in the next year, but I don't know long term. I don't know how much more time at work I'm going to have to be there. I don't know what the demands are going to be. So the benefits seem more unknown than the costs. And again, when the women are more focused to begin with in terms of deciding, the costs are more determinative, you can see how that's really going to be a huge issue.
Absolutely. So I want to change directions just a little bit and talk about chapter 6, the utter importance of pillow fights. Tell us, what does that mean? And why are they important?
She's leaning away from me, I think, because she knows there's a couch with pillows. Well, you know, it's interesting. There was a line of research that really began in the 1980s, became popularly aware of, at least, called attachment parenting. And attachment parenting was this idea that to be psychologically secure, you had to be comforted as a child, know that your parents were always there to comfort you. And the best way to do that was actually to be physically attached. That's sort of why the sort of papoose things became so popular, because that was physical attachment to the baby, so that you knew how at any moment the baby was doing, that the baby knew at any moment that you knew how the baby was doing. So that the baby wasn't concerned if it had a need, it would go unmet. And this has been an enormously, I think, influential idea in parenting for the past 10, 20 years. But Daniel Paquette, a researcher at the University of Montreal, I found his research, and he was saying, whoa. And anytime someone says, oh, I'm like, really? What do you got? And he said that in the story of attachment parenting and the focus on nurture, we were forgetting that there was another half of parents' job, which is exciting kids, encouraging kids to explore and to push forward. And I keep thinking, you know, it's true, right? We keep asking kids as infants, come on, walk, it's okay. And if they fall to the ground, you just pick them up and say, no, no, try it again. But our responsibility to tell them stand up and know that they're going to fall right back down doesn't end when they can finally walk across the floor.
Nope. I have teenagers.
But it's hard, right?
It's very hard.
And at a certain point, they're going to be exploring on their own. Every parent of a 2 or 3 year old, you know, and they're chasing them around the room is probably going, yeah, I can't get my kid to, you know, explore any less. But we are having this sort of tension in terms of pushing kids forward and when to excite and when to explore. And even the attachment literature isn't that the kid's physically attached. That's not the sign of a kid who's going to do well. It's the kid who is attached for a minute in the face of a stranger and then goes, oh, well, that doesn't look too scary because I know you're here, so I'll come back if there's a problem. And then they go. Mm-hmm. So there is still an exploration even in the attachment. So Paquette's work, he looked at kids and roughhousing. And what he found out was that, you know, siblings, roughhousing, it always starts fun, right? And you don't need to break something, but suddenly at some point, Mom, he hit me. Well, you guys were wrestling on the floor, but he meant it. It hurt, right? And it invariably always happens that way. Some calamity, and all of a sudden the laughs and the joking and the pushing becomes either anger or tears. Just happens. But parents also roughhouse with kids. Now, when we're talking about roughhousing, we are talking about, you know, wrestling, but we're also talking about tickling, chasing kids around the room. I'm gonna get you. You know, when you're 2 or 3, that's just so exciting, right? For me, you know, it's tickle monster. The tickle monster's coming. And Paquette's found that actually roughhousing led by parents is really good for kids. Because the idea is that you're pushing kids to that excitement, to that engagement, but just before they lose it, they stop.
and you're giving them this experience on testing themselves. I mean, if you think about a competition, we all know times when people were doing really well and they were really engaged and all of a sudden they just lost it, right? And it could be John McEnroe screaming and throwing a tantrum on the tennis court, but it could also be, you know, some boss or someone in a meeting who was just so engaged that all of a sudden they're yelling and they've just got having a tantrum.
Right.
And that's because they've gone too far. They're pushing themselves to the point that they've lost that ability to stop for a second and say, hey, where is this? Why are we doing this? What's so important? Why have I flipped out? And that early training, the ability to turn that on and off, can actually be helped develop by parents during roughhousing. And that's why it's so important that it's a parent driving it instead of the kid. Mm-hmm. Because your sibling doesn't know when you're going too far and that you're about to freak out. But the parent looks at the kid and says, oh, I see that. And then they stop. So now, for me in the Tickle Monster, if the kid starts getting and you could just like see it and they start shaking because they're so excited, I physically freeze. I turn into a statue. And it's really interesting because sometimes kids will just sort of stand there and look at you with really wide eyes waiting for you to come and get them. And some kids will say, stop, don't tickle me. Okay, you can tickle me more now. I don't tickle those kids. Instead, I say, the Tickle Monster decides when the Tickle Monster is going to tickle you. You have no say in the matter. And they know you can tickle me now, but no, you can't tickle me now. And it's really interesting because that approach, Paquette has found 3-4 years later, those kids are unsuccessfully aggressive. And by that, what we mean is they perceive threats that aren't really there.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they're actually, you know, lashing out, or they're doing too strongly. They're sort of striking out because they can't quite figure it out. So I'm forcing the kids, when I'm saying the Tickle Monster's not here, to stop paying attention to their excitement, but instead to look at me and see, what am I doing? Am I a threat? Am I just standing here? Does the Tickle Monster seem like he may be coming back? Or are we done and we can just sit down and calm down for a little while? So it's about focusing on what are the other people's emotions are doing so that you can do both, and that then helps your own managing.
Wow. Fascinating.
I know, it's so cool. I love my job.
And you do a very good job at it. And this book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, is a masterpiece. Nurture Shock was. And I encourage everyone, all of our listeners, to read it. And I talk about it all the time in my negotiations, in my discussions, as I talk to people about something that they need to do to understand how they can better be successful in their careers.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So thank you for calling us, letting us come into your beautiful house. It is packed with papers, but it
packed
is really
books
fun.
And yarn and paper, yeah.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see your crochet. You can brag about it.
It's right over there.
So we are here on the Incandescent Radio Network. Last question for Ashley Merriman. How do people get in touch with you?
It's pretty easy, actually. TalkDogBook.com has information about where we are. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/AshleyMerriman, and I'm on Facebook and email. I'm not the, somewhere in the Midwest, there's a track star in high school who recently was homecoming queen.
That's not
me. No, I wish it were, but I'm not nearly that cool. But the other ones, that's me.
Excellent. Top Dog is the book. You're listening to the Incandescent Radio Network. We are thrilled to have you with us. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for your time.
So that's it for today's Incandescent Entrepreneur Show, where we always ask, what's your story? If you have a good one and would like to be interviewed on the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show, send me an email to hope@hopegibbs.com. Check back every Monday at noon for a new episode of the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, www.incandescentradio.com. We look forward to talking to you next week. Here's to your incredible, indelible success.